Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Welcome. Did you turn our mics on this time?
Yes, I did. Shut up. Nobody has to know. It didn't happen if it didn't make it through the edit.
You know what? I'm getting something to drink. You do the fucking promo. You know what? You and I are fucking done professionally, man.
Oh, shut the fuck up. Anyway, so if you want to give us some help and you're going to buy some stuff from Amazon, and who doesn't buy stuff from Amazon, really? Just go to 1201beyond.com. Clear your cookies. Turn off your ad blocker. Go through our suggestions, one for the UK, one for the US. And if you're going to buy something from Amazon, you may as well shoot us a small percentage of what you get. I think last time I looked, we made about $25.
It's dinner.
It's dinner. That's right.
All right. Now, who would have thunk we could have drugged the 1990s out into three episodes?
Oh, but 10 years and three episodes. Easy to do.
All right. Now, this one, we're going to tackle comic books first. Because
all you.
No, because you're going to have some input here, too.
Okay,
so,
okay.
But the 90s were a very, very dark time for comic books. Yet, it's the exact opposite for what most people would think of for the 90s when it comes to comic books.
Okay, why is that?
The speculator boom. Because, see, what happened was, you know, comics were pretty good sellers. And then I don't know what the very first one of these was. I know what the first huge one was for whatever reason, Marvel Comics decided with Silver Surfer number 50 to have a special foil embossed cover that kind of popped off of the page. And they noticed the sales jumped almost 1,000% for that issue. And they're like, what the gimmick cover. So then they started having, you know, number one issue, gimmick cover. Number 25 issue, gimmick cover. 50th issue, gimmick cover. Character dies, gimmick cover. Just random, hey, it's number 38, gimmick cover. And they started noticing people were buying these things in massive numbers to speculate on them. So it was all about...
And by speculate, you mean the collector's market.
Yes, where, okay, if I buy this for $2.50... In 3 months, it's going to be worth $5. I just doubled my money. And what people don't seem to realize is the law of supply and demand. If you buy 50 copies of a, excuse me, if you buy 50 copies of a book that no one wants to read, that doesn't make it worth anything.
True.
Also, the fact of like the Spider-Man number one, the Todd McFarlane Spider-Man number one in the 90s, it sold 6 million copies. That might not sound like a lot, but that for a comic, for a single issue of a comic book, that's a lot. When there's 6 million copies of a book out there, it's not going to be worth anything because they are so common. If you want them, any comic store will have them for a dollar or two.
See, and I remember the 90s comics, and again, I was never a comic book guy, but my friends in the 90s were. And so I remember them making just weekly trips to the comic book store, and I remember, you know, the hollow foil covers and the some of them, I forget what, I think it was one of the issues the X-Men had the hologram,
yep,
on the cover and stuff like that. And I remember the 90s for me, I saw lots and lots of people buy lots of books because they wanted to read them, especially the X-Men series, just because that's
not really because this is to feed into the speculator market. Even when it wasn't gimmick covers, it was gimmick characters. Let's create a character specifically so we can, hey, the first appearance of this character is now worth $20. Catch up on his stuff in our trade paperbacks. They started writing to the speculators instead of to the readers. And okay, that was a huge problem. And then, of course, the Image thing happened where all some of their, and I'm going to put this in quotes, best artists defected from Marvel and DC to form their own company. And then you had another dark time for comic books when artists, and I'm not saying artists, you know, visual artists are not inherently good writers. These were people who would draw comics and had never written one in their life and now said, I'm the writer now too. You had some of the worst comics ever written, created between 1992 and 1995, because the artists thought they could write.
But didn't you also have a little bit of an indie boom? I mean, you know.
The indie boom was really big in the 80s. That was after TMNT, that's when you saw the indies. And in the 90s, you even saw the indies become the majors. Well, Dark Horse used to be an indie company.
I was going
to
say.
They became a major company in the 90s.
I was going to say, I remember the rise of a couple of my friends getting really into the Dark Horse deals and then really into. Weren't there some short-lived crossover stories that involved, like, everybody and their fucking brother got together for this one comic book?
Yeah, and then there was the whole Marvel DC nonsense where you, the readers, get to choose who wins the fight. Yeah, because that's not going to backfire on you.
Well, who knows? You know, for me, the 90s were a comic book boom, not because I was into them, but because I had so many friends that were into them that seemed to really be enjoying the books that came out.
Well, look at it this way. You go to any comic store nowadays, you look through their 25-cent box, or their 10-for-a-buck box, three-quarters of that is all 90s stuff. And I know from Powers Comics here in Green Bay, they won't even buy 90s stuff. If someone's buying a collection, or they're buying a collection from somebody, they'll just hand all the stuff, all the 90s stuff back to them. They're like, I have 40 copies of each one of these already. I don't want them. Just donate them to Goodwill or use them to start a bonfire. You know, these Warriors of Plasm issues are worthless. They're not even worth the paper that they're printed on.
So you're just saying that there was a supply side glut.
Yes. There was far more supply than there was demand because they were going, well, issue number one sold 1 million copies. Let's print 2 million copies of number two. Shit, it only sold 400,000. Fuck!
Okay.
So the 90s were a dark, dark time for comics.
I'm going to have to take your word for it, and I'm really going to have to bow to the readers for this one to defend 90s comics if they're out there.
You're not going to find a whole lot of defense. You're going to find a lot of people that go, no.
Okay. I don't know. But now, let's move on.
Is it just me that's sounding all metallic in my ears? Or
it's you just you, because I don't hear you metallic at all.
Okay. Well, speaking of that segs into, what do you want to tackle first? Technology in general or the internet?
They really kind of go together.
Right, that's why I'm saying, but which one do you want to tackle first? I'd say technology in general.
Okay, we can do that.
Because you had... And you are not going to catch me bitching about the fact that we needed stepping stones. Okay,
right.
You know, I bitch about how bad the internet was and things like that, but I do see that there were those were stepping stones to what we have today.
Even with cars, I mean, you look back on the Model T, one of the best selling cars in the U.S. ever, but you look at it today compared to my little Ford Taurus. It's a shit car. I mean, they're neat. They're fun to work on, but they're unsafe. They don't run real well. They've got the thin tires, et cetera, et cetera. But it was an important stepping stone because it showed us that if you make it on an assembly line, it can be cheap and blah, 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 blah,
well,
blah, blah, blah.
And then see, that's my point. While I will put them in their proper historical context of being a stepping stone, all the technology I'm going to bitch about, that doesn't mean that it was good technology in and of itself.
Give me an example.
For instance, Super VHS. You remember Super VHS, right?
Yes, I do.
For those that don't, that was basically... laser discs were still way too expensive. So
right, right.
And you couldn't record on them.
DVDs were just
DVDs didn't
starting,
even exist yeah. yet. No, when Super VHS came out, DVDs were still science fiction. VCDs existed.
And VCDs were crap. I'll
VCDs
give you
were always shit. And there was a big boom in them for a while, too. I saw there was everyone on the internet was talking, and I'm talking early internet here, was talking, oh my God, VCD, it's watching a movie on a CD.
But you have to understand, without VCDs, we wouldn't have DVD.
I get that, but like I said, that doesn't excuse the fact that VCD was a pile of shit.
And it was even
it
in its
just,
day.
Yeah, it just provided the stepping stone necessary for something better. But Super VHS was them going, okay, we want the clarity of a movie on Laserdisc, but we want it on VHS. So what they basically did is they basically took what you and I from working in TV knew as Betacam SP format, and they made that for VHS. And then you had to buy a new VHS player because a normal video VCR couldn't play that. And this lasted about a year. It actually died faster than HD DVD did. Super VHS was a train wreck.
Yeah.
And that was one of those. And if you read some, like, even Wired issues from the 90s, Super VHS, it's the wave of the future. It's better than VHS. Oh, wait. No, it kind of sucked.
Well, it's not that the technology itself sucked. It just never caught on. It never, it was, you know, it's, the only reason that Blu-ray has survived is because so much stuff is coming out on Blu-ray and you're getting more and more exclusively Blu-ray stuff. And people, you know, I'm actually, you know, and the players have come down in price and came down in price very quickly.
DVDs did the same thing.
You know, DVDs did the same thing. And that's why Blu-ray has survived. SVHS, the players were always expensive. They didn't have a chance to come down in price. The tapes were very expensive. They never had a chance to come down in price.
And all honesty,
DVD popped up and we were like, aha.
Well, and then you really, the quality increase you got on Super VHS was so minimal that it was just was not worth buying a new player and buying your whole collection over again. Whereas, like, I'm a big VHS guy. And sometimes DVD looks just like the VHS tape. When it's done properly, a DVD does look a lot better than a VHS tape.
Yeah.
I give you that, when it's done properly. With Super VHS, it was, it's a little clearer.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, it's not worth the $400 new player and the, you know, $80 tapes. It's just, it was just a bad idea, or an idea that maybe what wasn't bad, it came too late. Maybe if they tried Super VHS in 1990, okay, that might have made a huge difference. When they tried it in 1995, no, it was too late. You guys fucked around too long.
DVD was already making inroads into the market then.
DVD didn't exist till 97.
On the high end, I thought it came around. Okay.
DVD made its debut in September of 1997.
But still, 1995 to 1997.
I know.
It's
relatively close, but that was the thing. Super VHS came out too late.
Right. And they were hyping DVD in 95.
Oh, yeah. There's this new thing coming.
Right.
It's funny when you look at, go back and find an old tech magazine from like 96 and look at how they were talking about DVD.
Yes.
It's funny how people go, oh, Laserdiscs are such shit. They were basically saying it's Laserdisc on a CD.
Yeah, basically.
And so it's kind of funny that people, oh, man, they're so much better than Laserdiscs, yet that's how it was basically advertised.
Anyway, but that's one tech thing. If you look at other, I mean, if you look at technology from the 90s, my God, Moore's Law is in full effect throughout the 90s. Every 18 months, we're going to double our processing power. That's Moore's Law.
Oh, okay. Now, I don't mean CD as in music CDs, okay?
Okay.
Look at CD technology versus the horrendous floppy disk technology. Floppy disks, you can fit, what, 1.4 megabytes or something on an average floppy?
Yeah, it depends on the floppy. On the little 3.5, 5.25. On the little 3.5, it's 1.44 meg.
Which, that's not even the photo you're taken by your cell phone nowadays is bigger than that.
Not now. You're right. And that's why most computers today, you'll notice mine doesn't have what I lovingly call an A drive, because it was always A.
That was always the A drive, yeah.
Exactly. You know, it doesn't have a 3.5-inch floppy drive. It doesn't have a 5.5-inch floppy drive. It's because these had their time. You know, in the 90s, the next big step in floppy that you had was you had the super floppy, which looked like a little 3.5-inch.
Did they call everything super when they made it in the 90s?
Well, you got to remember the Super Nintendo was out.
Yeah, but a Super VHS and we had Super Beta, the TV.
Yes.
Everything was super whatever
because it was the next step. But you had the super floppies that Instead of having the little rectangular
shape
piece of metal.
Okay. Oh, yeah. The little slidey.
They were the same shape. It's just that the slidey was a triangle now, and it held 10 times the amount of a regular floppy. Those lasted about a year, maybe.
Was that before or after zip drives?
That was right. They
were, that was yeah. in the zip drive.
They were fighting one another.
Tell the audience what a zip drive is if they don't know. I can't describe it as well as I'm sure you can.
No problem. A zip drive, if you set it next to a regular floppy, you would notice that it's a little bit thicker and it's a little bit larger. And it held about as much as a super floppy did. And they were great because this was, you got to remember, this was when art and computers were clashing.
This is before writable CDs were right. affordable. They existed.
They existed.
But they were, you know, a writable CD drive was $1,000.
Not, well, the drives were sitting around 800.
Yeah.
And then the media themselves is what really got you because you got 10 of them for about $100.
Yeah, so you did not want to waste them. So for those of you that are going, well, what about CDRs? No, those were not a viable option at this point.
They were still for the elite. And CDRW
didn't even exist.
It wasn't around. But anyway, zip drives held about 100. It held about 100 floppies in what was roughly the same shape and size. And when you get big, when you have graphic artists starting to use computers and pads and stuff to do this stuff and really transmitting these large files over a phone line to the internet wasn't viable at the time. It took too long. It was a pain in the arse.
You basically need a Johnny Mnemonic to stick the needle in his head to curry it from location A to location B.
But these zip drives held about 100 floppies worth of stuff. Really, really great. MP3s were just starting to make their way in as a mainstream music thing.
And you could not fit an MP3 on a floppy.
You could fit maybe one or two if they were
small.
Highly, highly compressed.
Yeah, okay.
But these zip drives, you could fit 7 or 8 of them on there. And then Zip came out with Jazz, which was like a zip drive, only circular.
I never had one. And I remember basically once CDR came out, the zip drives went, oh, fuck, we're dead. And they did not last much longer.
Two things killed zip drives. One, your CDRs, when they came down in price and when the media came down in price, yes, it when they became viable, yeah, that kind of killed the zip drives. The other thing that killed the zip drives was there was a glut of them. First, you had Zip, which was a great little successful company, and it did what it was needed to do.
Basically, they got hit with all the knockoffs.
Then they came out with Jazz. Jazz held as much as 10 zip drives. Then you came out with Click. Then you came out with what really, really killed the zip drive, USB.
Ah.
And USB
is what we still use today.
Yeah, well, but regular USB hard drives that could simply be plugged into a computer and were full-size freaking hard drives. And you could go, here's my computer, dump. All right, it's on this drive now.
Well, it's kind of funny, and I, this is not a bitch about the 90s, okay?
Okay.
But it's kind of funny when I look back at the first computer I got in 1996. Guess how big of a hard drive it had.
Let's see here, 1996, you're probably looking at 800 megs?
2 gigs.
2 gigs, oh, okay.
I couldn't even store, I couldn't even put 2 modern movie trailers on that thing. And I was happy. Oh my God, it's 2 gigs! I'm never going to be able to fill up 2 gigs, Scott!
I've said that about every computer I've had, from the Apple IIe. You know,
that 2 terabyte fills up real fast, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, and you think about it, but you also have to remember that this is, you know, let's take a look at one of the biggest selling things prior to the internet, Encarta, which was, it was an encyclopedia on CD, and oh my God, it had little videos, little postage stamp size videos that
early QuickTime
were a few, maybe a minute long. But that was amazing.
And that looked worse than a Sega CD game.
No, not really. Not if you had a system powerful enough to really display it well. Mm. They didn't look bad. They were just fucking tiny. But, you know, and that was a big deal. And it was thanks to the 90s that we see this. Even up to the end of the 90s, we're starting to see the demise. We're just now starting to see the demise of the hard drive, period. And I'll go out
that cloud shit?
No, not cloud stuff. I think that the hard drive will, before it's replaced by the cloud, and cloud storage has its good and bad. And
I don't trust that shit. It makes me too nervous.
And you're actually amongst the majority of people that will go, okay, I'll keep some of my, you know, I'll keep my work stuff on the cloud.
I'm going to keep the tranny porn on my hard drive where no one else can see it.
I'm going to keep the stuff I want to keep on my hard drive. But what I think is within 10, 15 years, you're going to see magnetic storage go away or get so huge that it becomes a specialty thing. It may not go away, but it'll become a specialty thing. What I think you're going to see them replaced by is solid-state drives.
Well, see, the way I look at it, 90s computers are just, they're so, and again, keep in mind I'm saying I get the whole stepping stone. They're so anarchic that,
fucking context, I don't, man.
I know,
context.
But I don't under... You're looking... I look back at my old computer, which I still have, and I hooked up just for the fuck of it last year. I actually said one of these, I don't know how I fucking used this. But, I don't know how this satisfied me.
Oh, my God, but you're looking at it through 2012 eyeballs. Look at it, you know, hook up that computer from 1996 and look at it through 1986 eyeballs. Fucking amazing.
Look at him. Did you see that fucking Friends How to Use Windows 95 video?
Yes.
You know, that made me just go, and that's 1995, and I'm going, holy shit, how the fuck did anyone ever get anything done on this dinosaur of a system? And you know me, I'm usually the guy that likes the dinosaur technology, not when it comes to computers.
That's because... You know, and I remember in 1989 and 1990 when I started going to Burris and we had access to the BSU internet and VAX system. I mean, I look back at that VAX system, I'm like, what? I wrote reports on this. I did email on this. I had internet, you know, IRC on this thing. And God bless you, widget on this thing. How in the world did I deal with that with the internet today? And that's because we're looking at it through 2012 eyes. But back then it was astounding. I can sit here and type very quietly in this computer lab and my friend who's across the room can see what I'm typing and we can talk without talking and the teacher will never know.
Well, okay, let's move off of computers for a second. Cell phones. Cell phones started to become more affordable in the 90s.
Yes.
So you started to see more and more people using them. Because in the 80s, they were the...
The bricks.
I always equate it to, you ever see the original War of the Worlds? Remember how they called in the airstrike? That's what an 80s cell phone was to me. It was like, okay, I'm going to call, you know, the airstrike on the Martians.
The most popular one, one of the first and to really popularize cell phone use was, they lovingly call it the Motorola brick. And it is about the size of a brick. And it, you know, I'm calling as I'm walking down the street. It's amazing. You know, my dad had one installed in his car. I don't know if you remember the old briefcase phones.
Yes. I actually have one. I found one at a Goodwill for $1 just for the shit of it. I bought one.
Yeah.
I don't even think I could get a service plan for it.
No,
anymore.
You can't. No, it's the radio spectrum that they use has been.
I think that would be fun to just put that in my car just for shits and giggles. And sure. I'm calling you from my car.
You know, and that was an amazing thing. I remember before he had a cell phone, my dad used his ham radio to patch into a phone line and use it. And that was astounding.
I remember you look at old 80s, late 80s, early 90s TV. Car phones were something rich people had.
Exactly.
Because something that most people might not realize about cell phones from the 80s and early 90s, the phones themselves came down in price. The plans and the minutes did not. Those things were monstrously expensive. So even if you could afford a cell phone, you could not afford to do anything except, do we need bread? Okay, bread, got it, click. You know, that was the kind of calls you made on early 90s cell phones.
Exactly. They were emergency only. Now we have smartphones and we have 4G and internet everywhere and data and everything like that. And it's They're amazing little things, but to tell you the truth, and this is going to amaze listeners, I carry a Pantech phone. It calls and it texts, and that's it. I got no internet on my phone. I got nothing. You carry, what is that, a little, what is this? USA. Oh, you carry an old LG flip phone, but I don't think that amazes any of the listeners at all. But this particular form factor, your little flip phone, came about in the 90s. Came about, I think it was 1991.
All I can do with this is it's got a tip calculator, a really low-res camera, and I can make and receive calls, and I can receive texts, but I do not have a texting plan, so I can't even text anybody back.
Yeah, that's no surprise to anyone.
Fuck off.
But that particular form factor came about from Motorola again. The StarTAC was the first little flip phone that was really affordable, and it was amazing.
Well, I remember the ones in the 90s where you had to pull the little aerial up.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I remember they don't even have aerials, and they don't even have that little nub anymore for the aerial
that's
that they
right.
used to have. But cell phones, again, I'm looking at the stepping stone angle, but my God, I don't know how anyone used a cell phone back then.
Same way they do, not the same way they do today.
Today it seems like kids, like there was a recent commercial on local TV for like US Cellular or whatever, and it's talking about all the data plans and all the texting and whatnot, and almost like an afterthought, at the end of the commercial they go, and it can make phone calls too.
Yeah, I know. I mean, phones have made their switch, but still, looking back at the 90s, this was when college students and people like that could first start being able to afford a cell phone and just being able to make a call while you're on the road or receive calls while you're on the road, and people still talk to one another. You know, that was astounding.
Well,
so I don't see what you're griping about. Look at how shitty yesterday's technology was, and I go, yeah, well, look at the cotton gin. That was pretty shitty technology back then, but
okay,
holy crap,
did
it revolutionize
things. If we're
going to
talk phones, look at just phones in the 90s. You know, the AT&T Family Plus plan, or good God, 10, you remember 1010, 220?
Yeah.
Because back in the age before cell phones, long distance was so expensive that 1010, 220, what it was is 20 minutes of long distance to anywhere in the United States. For $1.
And that was a big deal.
That was a big fucking deal.
And do you know what changed that?
I don't know.
Okay.
Cell phones allowing you free long distance?
Yeah, cell phones played a big part because the cell phone companies went, okay, we're not using the phone network, which is what the reason long distance was so expensive was because all the different municipalities, if you made a call from here to Milwaukee, on a regular phone network back in the 80s, your local phone, your local AT&T provider your local AT&T provider would get a cut. The national AT&T company, and remember, this is still before they broke up Ma Bell, would get a cut. The Milwaukee one would get a cut. And then you've got those three all charging you for use of their network. Cell phones went, we're making our own network, Sprint and
U.S. Cellular.
U.S. Cellular, and then some of, but it wasn't, it was mainly Lucent Technologies was what was who was leading the charge on making the cell phone network. They basically went, we're not using your network, we're going to charge our customers directly, and we don't care where they are, so boom. Free long distance via cell phone. The other thing that happened was voice over IP, and this came about in the late 90s. But voice over IP, which is voice over internet protocol, came about not just with Skype and with Qphone and with some of those other little programs that the very early starting ones, but it became viable for cable companies that were providing the internet. Just went, okay, we came up with this little box, we'll put it in, and suddenly you're using the internet for your regular house phone. No long distance charge there. And it was the break, you know, the all the little Ma Bell company breakup that they did were the ones that killed themselves because they were all competing with one another and they all own different parts of the network.
Speaking of the internet and phones, I mean, obviously when I say you, I don't mean you because I know you know this.
I know.
Do you out there, any of you remember the era of pay-by-the-minute internet?
Sure.
Holy shit, how did we ever survive pay-by-the-minute internet? I mean, internet is so ingrained in our lives today. Can you imagine a pay-by-the-minute internet today? And when I say pay-by-the-minute, it was not cheap.
No.
I mean, you were almost paying a dollar, I think, every 2 minutes. It was almost 50 cents a minute to just be on the internet. And this is the slow internet where it would take 5 minutes to download a naked photo of Kate Mulgrew.
Okay. My first internet provider was General Electric. It was a pro.
I'm still with my first internet provider.
I know. Nobody is surprised by this. My first internet provider at home was General Electric, GE.
Okay.
I got 15 minutes of internet time a month for $10. And then suddenly that jumped up to an hour of internet time for $10. And then AOL, and then Prodigy came along. And Prodigy just said, use it.
And then AOL, for those that don't remember, when they would send out those millions of startup disks, it would be like 100 hours free,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah. And okay, that was interesting enough. And then finally, the proliferation again of to the curb internet service. And really, it was Clinton was the one that came along and said, hey, this internet is great. Everybody should have it. So he started looking at it like a public service. And so he gave... He and the Congress at the time gave companies government incentives to get 24-hour high-speed connection out to the curbs to every house because Clinton really did see the revolution coming of the information, you know, the coming revolution of the information age.
It took a while because I remember my wife's uncle, and this is in the 2000s. This is maybe 02, 03. You know, he was into flight simulators, same as you. And he was only ever able to play them online on weekends because that's the only time he got free internet on his dial-up.
Sure.
Because there was no broadband or anything available out in the middle of the country. So he's like, I'm still on dial-up in the 2000s, and I get free nights and weekends kind of thing. So that's the only time I can play an online game.
And that's the way it is.
That's ridiculous.
That's the way it
is. In the 2000s.
They're working on it. Okay? I mean, it's a big country. And that's a lot of infrastructure getting stuff to the curb out there in the rural areas. They've come up with a solution, thank God. There are a couple. One, there's high-speed satellite downlink, which you still have to dial to upload. But luckily, most people don't upload a lot. They're downloading most of it. So there's high-speed satellite download now, and there is now radio internet as well. It's basically a wide area network over... You can think of it as a super powerful Wi-Fi network. So you put an antenna up on top of your house and it runs down to a little router in your house and there you go.
Well, to go back to the 90s, you know, you had dial-up, which, again, we were just astonished at how fast it was then. Nowadays, you go, how did I live on dial-up?
Okay, my first dial-up modem that I ever had access to was for an Apple IIc. It was my friend Greg had one, and it was a 300 baud modem. And to give you an idea of how slow it was, Greg and I had fun, just great fun, downloading things like ASCII art, which is just like art created with text symbols.
Oh, I've seen a bunch of them.
Yeah. And I remember it drawing it out line by line like an old dot matrix printer.
That's exactly what I was thinking of when you said line by line. Yeah. I'm like, you mean like those old printers?
Exactly. Just like an old dot. And then 288 came along. And that was my first modem I ever owned was a 288. And oh my God, it was fast enough we could actually transfer pictures, real pictures.
And chat in real time.
And it was astounding. And then 56K came along. And holy fuck, 56K was blazing at the time, and it was I could get on and in back in my Genie days, what I'm doing with my 288 modem, that would take me 15 minutes to post and read my news groups that I like doing stuff with, suddenly transferring files like sounds and in short video deals became viable.
I remember
because
my
of this speed
on my first 56K dial up. And now this is going to sound weird with today everybody thing being so fast. Like, say a 2.5 minute movie trailer in QuickTime, and QuickTime was the most viable format back then.
QuickTime and RealPlayer.
RealPlayer was always shit as far as I was concerned, but yeah. It would take, say that 2.5 minute trailer would take almost an hour to download the trailer. Can you, can those of you out there imagine, you want to see the, and I remember this even in the 2000s, because I remember doing this on for the X-Men trailer in 2000. You know, when it first, oh my God, the X-Men trailer. I'll come back in an hour and watch it when the whole fucking QuickTime downloads.
But you could do it. And if you did go to college in the 90s, holy crap, I had a T1 coming right into my dorm room. Oh, wow.
The you T1 just went all Don LaFontaine right there for
yes,
a second.
For a moment. But the...
in a world.
In a world. But it was simply the fact that you could do it. One of the first boards back when, before it was really the internet was a viable thing, that we had BBSs,
yep.
Bulletin board systems. We had
hackers
one
loved those.
Yes, yes, we did. We had one called the Muncie Micro Users Group. And just the fact that I had access to this library of information that my local actual library didn't carry or wouldn't let me see, like the Anarchist Cookbook or stuff like that, or the hacking texts, how to build a blue box, how to build a green box, how to build a red box, black box, etc. It was astounding to me at the time that I even had access to that information. I remember the first time that I did online research for a report, as opposed to going to the library and getting the encyclopedias and doing that, or going back to my 1977 Childcraft encyclopedias. You know, it was just the fact that this could be done, that we had access to this stuff, was astounding. And again, you're looking at it through 2012 eyes, and I can understand the frustration. I can understand why you're like, oh, how did we live with it being so slow? But then if we go back and we look at it now, you look back at your childhood and you go, oh my God, how did we live without it?
Well, let's also look at some of like the browsers. For those of you out there, Netscape.
Netscape was a great little browser in its time.
Yeah, clearly, since you have a defaming, derogatory term for it.
Hackers do that for everything. Excuse me, everyone. I'm sorry. You know, the
I don't know the history of Netscape. It seemed very similar to Internet Explorer. Did that kind of turn into Internet Explorer or not? I don't know the history of that.
No. Okay.
Because, like, I used to, before I had a computer, I'd go to the library to use the internet, and they only had Netscape.
The first browser that came around was a version of Netscape. It was Mozilla. And it was the guy in charge was Tim Berners-Lee, who did a little thing like invent the World Wide Web, or at least help. The Mozilla Foundation was the one that came up with the Mozilla browser, which eventually turned into Netscape. In the meantime, Microsoft is looking at this going, hey, we should get in on this browser stuff and just build it into our operating system. And they built it right into Windows 95. I don't know if you remember that whole court case.
I don't remember the court case, no.
But nonetheless, then you had Internet Exploder. And that came out...
Your cat is climbing me.
I know. She does that. You know, that came out of code from the Mozilla and the Mozilla browser and the stuff that Tim Berners-Lee came up with. Mozilla went, there's a lot of stuff that we don't like about Internet Explorer, so rather than trying to do our stuff for Microsoft, we're going to do our own thing, and Mozilla browser turned into Netscape. Netscape turned into Netscape Communicator eventually, which Netscape Communicator was too much all at once, because in one screen you had a messenger, you had a little tree that was your internet history, you had all of your bookmarks and all of that stuff all thrown together on one screen, and this was, you know, this was, you had your IRC client in there, and basically it was Netscape Communicator can do everything you want to do online all at once right here, all in front of you. And that, and it was huge, and it was bulky, and it was before its time.
Well, the way I look at it, like, I used to love Internet Explorer, and then I eventually moved to Firefox. And whenever I have to go back to Internet Explorer. Okay.
Mozilla Foundation became Firefox.
Okay. Because my thing is, and yes, I do still use Internet Explorer for some things. Like, there are certain online videos on Blip. They will not play on Firefox, no matter what I do. They just keep the little, you know, loading wheel. So I'll load up Internet Explorer, pop the Addy in, plays right away. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I have to watch videos in Internet Explorer because it just, Firefox, whatever reason, is going, no, not happening, all right?
May I introduce you to Chrome?
I'm not downloading Chrome 2. The only thing that's pissing me off about Firefox right now, if I get one more unresponsive script error, I think I'm going to punch through my screen.
Okay, that's...
I am so sick of every page I go to. Warning, unresponsive script.
Yeah.
And then it always asks me, do you want me to stop or wait? And I click, always do this action, stop. And yet every time it asks me, warning, unresponsive script. It's like, God damn it, I already told you, just stop the fucking script.
You told it what to do on that particular one page. Anyway.
Then is there a way I can tell it to, whenever unresponsive script, just stop it?
Sure, Google.
What?
Google it. It'll teach you how to go into your settings and change it. And then the other thing that you can do also while you're at Google is download Chrome.
Me.
Yeah, I know. But nonetheless, you know, all of this stuff kind of found its way out from Mozilla Foundation. And I don't know what to tell you other than, I hate to say it, but with the exception of Chrome, you're using the same browser.
Well, okay. Let's take a look at web pages. Frames.
Yeah, frames were amazing back in the day.
They were annoying back then. They're annoying now. When you, there are still, because after you told me Angel Fire still was there, when I was on Geek Juice later that night, I told them that, and Alex went and found his old Angel Fire Powerpuff Girls page still existed.
I saw that.
Oh yeah, I was trolling him on Facebook about that.
And
he's like, oh my God, frames.
Yeah, I mean, frames, that was a design choice that kind of popped into fashion. And prior to having CSS and all of the code that we have today, frames was the only way that you could go over here and click something over here and have it load something over here, over there, you know, somewhere
over
different.
Here, over there.
Yes, you know, and it's the only way that you could go to the left side of the screen and have it load something on the right side of the screen. Frames basically broke you up into, instead of looking at one web page, looking at three.
Well, and then you also had the hell that was, as you already brought up, RealPlayer. I'm sorry, RealPlayer was always shit. I never was able to get RealPlayer to work properly. QuickTime did what it was supposed to. RealPlayer, every time. Buffering. I got to the point where I said, if I see buffering one more time, I'm going on a shooting fucking rampage.
And that's what killed Real. Real had some great ideas. They really did. And they had some great code. And to tell you the truth, that little .rm file format for its day was brilliant because they were able to take long videos and compress them into a point to where it was viable to transfer them over dial-up. You may have had some problems with buffering. Everybody had problems with buffering. But just the fact that you could take an entire movie trailer on a dial-up connection, click go, and have it in 5 minutes as opposed to 50, it was amazing. The problem with Reel, and this is a problem that a lot of tech companies faced in the 90s and luckily are starting to get over, is that they threw in glut. Look at Windows Media Player from Windows 3.1. Click the file, it plays. And it's usually a WAV file, later an MP3, maybe a movie file. And look at VLC today. Click the file, it plays. Take a look at Windows Media Player now. you have your library on one side and your viewing screen here and all of your media just listed down
here.
And
here's the online stuff. I like that. The only thing I hate about VLC is I got to click each song I want to listen to or have a predetermined playlist. Whereas Windows Media Player, everything's just there and it just goes from one thing to the next no matter what I do.
Which means I'm going to have to teach you how to use VLC. But
sometimes you are such a bitch that even Joan Crawford would roll her eyes at
you. But Real Player did two things. One, it started the whole glut thing because it would throw its advertising partners right up there.
I remember the ads in the corner and shit,
The ads in the corner and everything. It would throw all of those up there. And Real Player, when the MPAA and the RIAA went to them and went, you're transferring files over the internet, and that's illegal. No, you have to pay us.
We've already talked about them as thug groups.
And when they sent their thug groups on to Real Player, Real just went, okay, and bent over backwards. And one of the things that causes all of that buffering was that Real used keys. In other words, you click on watch this preview in a website. That would then go to another server and go, okay, the video is located over here, but wait, if you want to watch the video over here, you have to have this key. So it would jump back to a key server at whoever ran the web page, and it would pick up that key, go to the key authentication, authenticate that key. Then that key and that authentication would be sent off to something run by the MPAA, which would then throw a permission file or a permission deal onto that key file. The key file would be sent back to them, back to the original web page, and then back up to the
look mousetrap
where the video was, and then the video would start to come down. And that's what killed Real Player.
I think it sucked. I mean, quick,
and it did.
QuickTime might have been shit. I mean, QuickTime was always all pixelized. I don't get it today when I still see some videos that are in QuickTime only format on the internet, and I just go, really? QuickTime?
Well, QuickTime,
there's all these other options, and you encoded it in QuickTime?
Yeah, QuickTime is still good because it does a couple of things. Yeah, it doesn't look as good, but it does compress things like you wouldn't fucking believe, which means transferring them can be really, really fast. Also, QuickTime has kind of morphed into it's the Apple fucking, let's see, your .move is QuickTime, and then there's
if you ever go to iTunes, it always tries to install QuickTime on your computer.
Well, that's because QuickTime and iTunes are integrated in one another. iTunes uses QuickTime all the time. QuickTime now really is just nothing more than a codec.
Well, and then before we run out of time, let's also talk about the other thing that the 90s gave us, which was shit on the internet, and that was early P2P.
I miss the shit out of real Napster. I miss the shit out of the days when not everyone had LimeWire or, you know, not everyone had BearShare.
All LimeWire was there for was to get viruses. It was like an unprotected sex with the street hooker.
LimeWire, BearShare, and stuff like that, before they became really popular, were really useful. Napster, back in its day, in its first incarnation, was fucking brilliant. I want this.
Until Metallica sued them.
There it is.
It's all Metallica's fault.
And one to look at now today, folks, if you're looking for obscure stuff and you want something with a relatively small populace, SoulSeek.
Actually, one of the best ones out there, private community, would be Cinemageddon.
Well, that's a torrent site. That's totally different. Okay. If you want a standalone client that's similar to old Napster and stuff, SoulSeek, SLSK.net.
Isn't Emule still is kind of a LimeWire-y it's not really torrents.
Okay, Emule is based on the same thing as BearShare and LimeWire, which are based. They're actually based on torrent technology, at its root. But Emule today is just loaded with stuff you don't want on your computer. It's also loaded with viruses. It's loaded with child porn. It's loaded with stuff and. It's also loaded with trolls who go, if I call this Star Trek, you know, the 2010 version, and I'm just going to load it up with viruses and porn, and ha 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 ha.
I totally got you.
Yeah, it's just dumb. And people still use Emule, but I can tell you that it's probably for mainly for trading porn that you shouldn't be trading.
No, no, no. The only reason I use it, it is for trading porn, but there are old 70s and 80s movies like Sex Crimes 2084. I couldn't find that on Cinemageddon. I couldn't find it on any of the adult torrent sites. Nothing. Someone had the fucking file on Emule, and it was the correct file.
Oh, good.
So every now and then, I do go there when I'm desperate for finding a video, and it's like, I can't find it anywhere else. Holy shit, it's on Emule. Someone's got it, and they're seeding.
I don't know. Maybe it's found its place. But all of this stuff was born out of the 90s and ideas in the 90s and that whole information.
But I think my point of the article, especially when it comes to the internet, was the ideas of the 90s far surpassed the technology of the 90s.
And that's the way it should always be. They
were too overthinking.
You should always have ideas that push your technology, because if you come up with ideas that just fit your technology, there's no need for evolution.
But then, using your model right there, but then what you do is you run into like the 90s where nothing works properly and it's so slow. Instead of going, all right, I've got this great idea, I'm not going to launch it until the technology is there.
No,
going to launch it now, even though it doesn't work right.
Okay.
That's like shipping a broken video game because we don't want to wait until we fix the bugs.
Oh. Funny you should mention that. But nonetheless, your ideas should always push the technology. Ideas pushing the technology takes the really expensive high-end technology and pushes it down into the hands of the people where it
consumer
fucking belongs.
Level.
Down to consumer level where it fucking belongs. If you didn't have ideas that push that, if you didn't have reasons for somebody to go, okay, let's make this cheaper and more available, then nobody would bother making it cheaper and more available. Always have ideas pushing technology. That's the whole idea.
But
I don't think
you should overreach the technology.
Yes, you should.
You've got stuff to go to like the video game consoles, stuff like the Phantom. Hey, look, we're going to be no games, no discs, nothing in the 90s. Oh, wait, shit, we're not even close to that technologically, so we go out of business. We overthunk where we were for the technology.
They didn't go out of business. They became on live.
Not in the 90s.
Not in the 90s.
And you know, you've got things like that. You've got all these tech things that are going, we can do this in 10 years when the technology actually gets there, but we're going to launch it now, so then we're ready in 10 years. And you go, but the now doesn't work.
But the now works most of the time. And most of the time when you have stuff that comes out like that, people understand. And it grows and it becomes something. I mean, Netflix. You can't tell me that you would have Netflix in the 90s.
I don't have Netflix now.
I do.
I don't.
It's not my fault.
I don't see the point in it.
But what I'm saying is that people couldn't, you couldn't imagine that kind of technology of in whatever, you know.
Actually, you could. Go back to our old, where's our retro future thing? Remember the old Tom Selleck commercial about, you know, you can, you know, have a library of 100 movies ready to come to your TV.
And, sure.
You know, they did imagine it then. And the technology was not even close to being there in 1994.
And it caught up. But I
yeah,
say...
Yeah, 15 years later.
I say that the reason that the technology caught up is because they had these ideas pushing it.
And see, I'm saying the idea, I'm not saying they shouldn't push the technology.
So you're saying,
I'm saying they shouldn't overthink it. They shouldn't push it to the point where we cannot do this, but let's launch it
wrong.
Anyway.
Push it to the breaking point and let the technology catch up.
I say have the idea, then develop the technology to implement said idea.
Nope.
Not let's try and wrap the idea around what we currently have.
Wrap the idea around what you currently have and allow the technology to grow around it. That's the whole point.
I disagree.
The way you're saying, I think the world would just stagnate.
Do I have a cat behind me or something?
I don't know.
I'm hearing noises. Well, I don't know. Well, we're running out of time anyway. So thanks for listening. I don't know what we're going to talk about next week, but we're done with the 90s. We got 3 freaking episodes out of this.
Yes, we'll get more.
And that was just a last-minute idea for the article that initially inspired this, too. It was,
yeah,
I can't think of what to write about. Hey, the 90s suck. Here we go.
And you sent me that list, and I was like, oh, fuck you. Well, 90s and were great.
Right. I'm just saying, this was literally a last minute, I have no idea what to write about this week. What the hell.
So what we've learned from these last three episodes is that the 90s were great.
They were a creative void of nothing, and they should be wiped out. They should be wiped out of existence, and no one should remember the 1990s. The 90s were bullshit. Absolute bullshit. Bullshit.